So what I'm going to talk about is some work on these double perovskite materials that we've been doing, this work done together with my student Ashley Cook, and it's the experiments were carried out in the group of Yeomjun Kim, neutron scattering at Toronto, and the samples were from collaborators in Korea. So what are these systems? So the double perovskites are, you know, very simple cubic lattice materials, and they have two different. So every site here has this cage of oxygen octahedra as in other perovskites. The only difference from the perovskites is that the two sublattices of the cubic lattice are different elements. So there are two different transition metal ions, B and B prime, that you can put the red and blue here, that form this alternating pattern. And given the wide variety of, you know, these transition metal ions that you can choose, there is a whole host of interesting physics that one can think about in these materials. So one example, for instance, is one where if we imagine that the red atoms in this one sublattice have no magnetism, no electronic states at all. So let's say it's some simple closed shell system, then these blue sites form an FCC lattice. So it's a frustrated lattice, and one can get interesting physics of spin liquids driven by frustration in some of these systems. And people have thought about, for example, materials like this one here, where the molybdenum 4D ions give rise to some interesting spin orbit coupled magnetism. There are also other systems where both sites may be magnetic, and these double perovskites provide sort of interesting examples of what are called half metallic magnets, where the magnetization on one sublattice is so large that it drives a system into forming sort of metallic bands, where the metallic bands are completely spin polarized. And people, and some believe that it might be useful if one thinks about, you know, things like spin injection, where you're trying to inject spin polarized currents from, let's say, such a system into some materials. And there are other examples of insulating ferry magnets and so on, which also sort of come about in these structures. So overall, these are kind of classes of, this kind of class of materials is kind of interesting to study magnetism and sort of transport. And some of the things we've been thinking about have to do with these kind of half metallic systems, but asking about the physics of spin orbit coupling, how it shows up in the magnetism and the magnetization dynamics. And more recently, some unfinished work trying to think about transport and, you know, kinds of quantum Hall like physics that emerges in these systems. So just to go back, so this is the system we are kind of thinking about, are systems where one of the sublattices is iron, okay, and it forms this large spin 5/2 magnetic moment that sits on one sublattice. The other sublattice, we've looked at a couple of different elements, one of which is molybdenum, which is in the 4D transition metal ion, and the other that we've explored is rhenium, which is a 5D transition metal ion, and really kind of trying to explore sort of the magnetism and transport, as I mentioned. So just to sketch the phenomenology of these systems, they look, you know, extremely straightforward as far as, you know, the magnetism is concerned. It's a very high transition temperature ferromagnet. So for example, in this BFR, this iron rhenium compound, there's about a 300 Kelvin transition temperature into a state where you get spontaneous magnetization. The transport looks, you know, pretty, I mean, nothing spectacular, but it's some metallic system. And similarly, there is similar sort of thing, but about happening at about 400 Kelvin in this other compound. And people have measured, so for example, when the system enters into the magnetic state, there is a slight tetragonality that develops. So you start with something that's cubic and it slightly shrinks along one of the axes when you enter the ferromagnetic state, suggestive that spin orbit coupling is playing a role in these systems. There is more direct evidence if one does what's called X-ray magnetic dichroism. There is a direct signature that both spin and orbital magnetization is present in these systems in the ground state in the ferromagnet. So what we looked at was kind of trying to model the system, trying to understand the magnetization and magnetization dynamics. So that will kind of be the first half of the talk. Okay. So these systems, as I mentioned earlier, the iron is nominally in a 3+ valence state. And so you have these 5 electrons which get Hund's coupled into a large magnetic moment. And so any electron that wants to come onto the ion necessarily has to point opposite to this existing magnetic moment. Okay. So it's sort of like in some of these other materials called manganites, where you again have a large magnetic moment, which in the case of that system only sits in the T2g orbital, and there's a large magnetic moment. And there the arriving electron has to be parallel to this underlying magnetic moment. Here it's the opposite. Here, because it's Pauli exclusion, you have to come in opposite to this existing magnetic moment. On the other sublattice, depending on which element we are looking at, we either have 2 or 1 electron sitting in the T2g orbital, which there is orbital degeneracy present in the system. If we think about this case, where there's 2 electrons, then in this 5D element, spin-orbit coupling is really strong. It's about 0.5 electron mold. In the 4D, it's a little bit smaller. It's about 100 MeV. But correlation effects, as we'll point out, play an important role here, where you have to, so at least at the atomic level, one has to take into account sort of the Hubbard interactions in the system. Okay. So if, in case there are people not familiar with some of this thing, what happens with spin-orbit coupling is that you can really think of these 3 levels here as forming an L equal to 1 angular momentum multiplet, and spin-orbit coupling will basically try to polarize the spin and the orbital angular momentum formed out of these things. So when you project the L dot S, there is an effective, like a ferromagnetic coupling between the angular momentum, orbital and spin angular momentum. And then the interactions are basically parameterized by, you know, the usual way, where you have an interaction that cares about, you know, the square of the total charge, the square of the total angular momentum, and the square of the total spin angular momentum. So you can write down effective interactions in this system. Okay.
So what's the scale for the Hund's coupling?
So the Hund's coupling is here, it's extremely strong. Here it's, I mean, it's not that, so here it's probably on the order of like 0.5 an electron volt. So it's probably 0.5 to 1 electron volt. So it's comparable to lambda. Here it's of course much, much stronger. Here it's about 2 electron volts in this one. So what is the physics? So in these systems, the magnetism, the ferromagnetism is thought to emerge through a kinetic energy mechanism. Basically, you want to try and delocalize the electrons on one sublattice. Okay. And the best way to delocalize, of course, is that the only way you can land on the ion moment is if you're anti-parallel to the ion moment because of Pauli exclusion. And so the way you want to minimize the kinetic energy is to allow this to, you know, delocalize as much as possible, which is only possible if the ion moments are aligned. Okay. So it's a kinetic energy driven ferromagnetism. And it turns out that, you know, even without taking correlation effects into account for the molybdenum, you can sort of get a reasonably good description of the ferromagnetic transition temperature that you get from. So it's about 400 Kelvin, 400 Kelvin TC, and you can sort of describe it reasonably well within such a simple mechanism. So what's not been studied is kind of, you know, various things related to, you know, correlation effects, spin-orbit coupling dynamics, and things that I'll talk about at the end related to quantum Hall physics in this problem. Okay. So one can sort of write down an effective, you know, something like a slave particle-like formula. It's not really a slave particle formulation, but basically your the electron that lands, you know, on rhenium, you can sort of describe the electron by having an orbital label and a spin label. Okay. But when the electron arrives on the ion site, the spin label is stripped off. You only have 1 spin orientation. And so one can write down an effective, you know, hopping between the rhenium and iron sites, which looks like this, where you have a spinful electron on rhenium or molybdenum, as it may be, hopping onto an effectively spinless particle on the iron site. Okay, so what do we get from this? So there is one level which you've done where we're trying to, you know, trying to ask, well, how reasonable is this description? And one way to do that is to try and compare, you know, the band structure that you would get from the previous kind of simple hopping model to try and compare it with some ab initio calculations. Okay, so on the right is not our work, ab initio calculations from some previous work. And we find that we can sort of get a reasonably good description for bands which are, you know, about an electron volt away from the Fermi level. So we see that there are all these bands here are really the rhenium and iron bands sort of put together. And one finds that there is this kind of half metallic state that emerges where the spin up bands are pushed up in energy because of this Coulomb repulsion in the ferromagnetic state, and the spin down bands form this completely polarized set of bands, and the Fermi level lies inside that. Okay, and that's kind of provides a fairly good description of the ab initio calculations, where basically you just keep everything. So what happens when we turn on spin orbit coupling, which is again not something that has been discussed in detail in this work here, is that we find the emergence of, you know, several weyl nodes in the Brillouin zone. As Anton was mentioning, this kind of expected to be a very generic phenomena. If you have a system that breaks time reversal and you have spin orbit coupling, then in three-dimensional systems, you expect these band touching points to exist. And there's a whole host of them that, I mean, I've not kind of marked it here, but there's a whole host of band crossings that really occur in this system because of that. Okay. And in this case, really, it's kind of an extreme limit of what Anton was saying, because the magnetization here is so large that really you begin with something that's almost completely spin polarized. And really these band touching points are then driven by sort of interorbital couplings and, you know, virtual transitions. If you have spin flip part of the spin orbit coupling, it really involves virtual transitions into the upper bands here. Okay. So if we don't take correlation effects into account, and this is some I have not shown the bands with that, but one doesn't get a good description of the bands in the problem. And in particular, the fact that these are half metallic bands actually doesn't show up in the calculation. So you can sort of see that the bands are not half metallic. Even though the ion moment is reasonably well captured, you know, without or with correlations, there is very little change. There is a huge difference on the other site. Namely, if you look at the rhenium site in this particular case, without correlations, there is very little magnetism on the rhenium site. Even though there is an effective Zeeman field that the ion neighbor sort of imposes, there is very little magnetism, but there's a huge magnetic moment that forms once correlation effects are taken into account. Okay, so this correlations and spin orbit and sort of Hund's coupling actually drives this very large magnetic moment formation on the 5D element here. Okay. And we can sort of also look at the ratio of, you know, what is the spin to orbital magnetism, and again, that's kind of in pretty good agreement with experimental data that I mentioned at the beginning. Okay. So it looks like, you know, one has to take this kind of correlation physics and spin orbit coupling in order to describe the sort of just the equilibrium physics, you know, band structure magnetism. And so the next thing we started asking was, you know, what does it imply for, you know, magnetization dynamics? So let's say I start looking at spin dynamics in a neutron scattering experiment. Does the formation of this local moments, which you've seen from this correlated kind of theory, does it actually show up in the experiment? So this is neutron scattering data just showing, this is just diffraction basically showing that, you know, if you look at the point that corresponds to, this wave vector here corresponds to having an antiferromagnetic order of moments on the iron site and the rhenium site. Okay, and what one sees is, this one here. And what one sees is, as you cool the system down below the transition temperature, going from, you know, about 400 Kelvin down to about 200 Kelvin, there is a development of this thing below TC, where this Bragg peak develops in the neutron diffraction experiment. So these, by the way, these are powder experiments. So we are really looking at the magnitude of Q on the x-axis. There is no directional information. Okay, but from the magnitude, you know where this point is in the 3D Brillouin zone. One can also look at the spectrum of excitations. And we see from the spectrum of excitations, there is this clear visibility of these two modes that emerge once you cool below the transition temperature. There is this two-peak structure that emerges in the scattering. And so unlike phonons, it turns out you can confirm that this is really magnetic in origin. because of the Q dependence of the intensity of the signal, which I've not shown here. So how do we start thinking about this thing? So what we've tried to do now in the next few slides is really trying to model this thing. So we've kind of got some intuition from the earlier calculation that there is local moment formation in the system. And so you can sort of start from an atomic perspective. So of course, it's at intermediate correlation. So you don't expect perfect atomic magnetism because of course, we know it's a metallic system. But a completely uncorrelated system is also not the correct starting point. And so this should be viewed as kind of a crude but reasonable first guess towards trying to understand this neutron spectrum. So at the atomic level, we have this kind of interaction that favors a large spin formation driven by Hund's coupling. And then there is this locking term of spin orbit coupling driven by spin orbit coupling. Okay? And now, if you do not have Hund's coupling at all, then really one goes back to this physics that's been discussed a lot in the context of the iridates. Okay? Namely, you have these fivefold this kind of six-fold degenerate T2G states counting for spin, and they are spin orbit split into a J of 3/2, a four-fold multiplet of 3/2 states, and a doublet, J equal to 1/2 doublet. And in the iridates, these states are all filled up, so it's a D5 system. And so in the iridates, a lot of the iridates, these are all filled states, and then this band is half-filled. Okay, so it gives like a spin orbit coupled version of TJ or Hubbard-like models in that case. Okay. Here it turns out that this is actually a very poor description once you start putting in two electrons. It's very far from putting two electrons into the J equal to 3/2 manifold. It turns out, in fact, that the large Hund's coupling limit is, in fact, very smoothly connected to the small Hund's coupling limit. And so, in fact, Hund's coupling completely changes the way you should think about this physics. You should really think if people are familiar with this atomic physics way of thinking about it, you really want to couple the angular momenta first, the spin momenta, and then spin orbit couple them. Okay, so it's I think it's called like the LS scheme as opposed to JJ coupling. I think it's called like the LS coupling way of doing it in the context of atomic physics. But really, it's just saying that this Hund's coupling is so large that I want to first lock the two spin half entities into forming a spin one. Lock the angular momentum to get like an L equal to 1, and then form total J states, which are take on 0, 1, or 2. Okay, and the J equal to 2 is the ground state, which has this fivefold degeneracy. Okay. So this is just comparing the energy levels from just diagonalizing this Hamiltonian, just plotting it, just to see how the levels change as a function of the Hund's coupling. All right, so we know that there must be this large magnetic moment both from sort of this earlier band theory with correlations as well as from this very simple, single atom physics of this system. And now we want to sort of ask, well, can I use this to get a good description of the data that we saw in the neutron scattering, from neutron scattering? Okay, so let's go back to sort of a simple toy model now, okay, where we say, look, there must be some, if I don't have spin orbit coupling, then I have spins on the two sublattices that talk to each other. And as we mentioned earlier, the two sublattices want to be oppositely aligned, so these electrons can delocalize. Okay? So let's think that there is some effective exchange interaction that's antiferromagnetic between these two neighboring sites, which are on opposite sublattices. And now, the only way these can interact with each other, there is no orbital angular momentum on the ion site. So the only thing I can have is some kind of an effective spin-spin coupling. Okay, between these two. The orbital moment on one sublattice cannot just couple to the spin moment on the other sublattice. Okay, so that's the simplest kind of Heisenberg-like model that you can write down. And then there is spin orbit coupling that, as we said, that locks the L equal to 1 and S equal to 1 to form a J equal to 2 state. Okay, so there is some effective Heisenberg-like description in the limit of large spin orbit coupling where you have some spin orbit coupled moment on one of them, talking to the spin moment on the other sublattice. Okay? And this is kind of an example of what people call a ferry magnet. So it's antiferromagnetically aligned spins, but with different net moments. So there is a net magnetization that develops. And the spin wave dispersion then has two branches that we can sort of work out the structure factor for. And it's an extremely good agreement with the data. So the left here, the experiments just shown, it's the same data, but this here is just zoomed in over a smaller energy momentum window compared to this one. And so if we powder average the result that I showed earlier, there is sort of a good agreement between the results, theoretical result, and the experimental results here. And what this allows us to do is to sort of extract the ratio of the magnetic moments on the two sides. Okay, so if you look at the zone boundary energies of this spectrum, basically the zone boundary energy just tells you what is the magnetic field seen by one sublattice due to the other sublattice. Okay, so very, very simple interpretation. And so if you look at the ratio of these two energies, it's simply a ratio of magnetic moments. And so we can sort of infer from the data that this experimentally it's about 1.6, and the previous calculation using, you know, band structure plus correlations gives you something a little bit higher, it's about 1.9. But what these experiments more importantly tell us is that the magnetic moment on the rhenium site is significantly bigger than one. Okay, so if you take two spin halves, you would expect if you only formed a spin angular momentum, you could have had a spin angular momentum of at most one. Okay. But we find something that's significantly higher, consistent with the fact that not only do you have these orbital magnetic moments in the ground state, but even when you start exciting these systems, they are still coherently locked together and participating in the dynamics. Okay. One can also estimate sort of what the exchange interaction is, and it's pretty small. Okay. And it's the high TC of this Ferri magnet is simply because it's a small exchange scale, but these are big moments. And in three dimensions, and so you end up with a pretty large transition temperature of about 300 Kelvin. It's kind of the right order of magnitude. Okay. So there is, I mean, okay, so you can sort of get a reasonable description of the other parts of the phenomenology. So the very weak tetragonal transition that I mentioned is really, again, driven by spin-orbit coupling. And if you think in terms of a Landau theory, you can write down an effective term that has sort of the cubic symmetry. And with the sign here, you can sort of figure out that there'll be this tetragonal distortion that happens. And so one can get sort of an understanding in this bulk system of the phenomenology of the electronic states, the phenomenology of the magnetism, and the magnetization dynamic. So what I wanted to turn to in the next few slides is some ongoing work where we've started looking at sort of what happens if you start thinning the system down, and in particular looking at what are called heterostructures, where you imagine trying to grow the system layer by layer. Okay, and this is kind of, there's all interesting physics, a lot of interesting physics that people have uncovered by thinking about these kinds of heterostructures. In particular, a lot of activity over the last few years on this lanthanum aluminate strontium titanate interface, where there is all kinds of interesting superconductivity and ferromagnetism, and there are lots and lots of experiments trying to, you know, look for what's the origin of these states and you know, what's the effect of, for instance, correlations that can, you know, promote this kind of magnetism at the interface. Okay, so the reason we kind of got interested is this paper that came out last year, where, or you know, end of 2012 sometime, is where you can actually grow these oxide superlattices going along the 1-1-1 direction. Okay, so not only can you grow cubes on themselves, you can also grow along the diagonal direction, where each layer is like a triangular lattice. Okay, and this is particularly ideal if you want to think about these double perovskites. Okay, because if you think about the double perovskites and you keep slicing them along the 1-1-1, then one triangular layer will be purely, let's say, iron. The next triangular layer will be purely molybdenum, okay? And so it's a particularly natural way to grow these kinds of double perovskite systems, okay? And in fact, this lanthanum nickelate, lanthanum manganite superlattice has actually been grown and shown to have some interesting physics already. So what we started looking at was trying to ask, well, what happens if you start looking at simple, you know, not kind of the bulk system, which of course we have the model for, but really asking what happens if you thin it down and start looking at small systems. And in fact, we are just focusing right now on just a bilayer. So you have one layer of iron and one layer of either rhenium or molybdenum setting. Okay. And that takes the form of this kind of honeycomb geometry, where, you know, one, this yellow site, let's say, is molybdenum, and the green sites are this iron. And so this is typical kind of honeycomb geometry from this two triangular lattices. And if you look at the magnetic moments, then the iron moments if you have a ferromagnet, would just be completely aligned. And the molybdenum is this kind of spin orbit coupled electrons that are now going to see this magnetic environment from the ion sites. Okay, so it's kind of a variant on the kind of things people have thought about, where you have orbital physics with spin orbit coupling and the presence of some kind of magnetic environment. Here it's a kind of slightly different thing, where there's kind of this non-local coupling between the iron and molybdenum sites on the triangular lattice, on the honeycomb lattice. Okay. So what happens to the magnetism in this geometry? It turns out the magnetism is not too different. Okay, namely, we've looked at a whole host of magnetic states, and this shows sort of what is the energy of different magnetic states, and this is just sort of just an index for the different states that we've looked at. So these are kind of the ferromagnetic states and corresponding to different orientations of the magnetic moment, and they all have much lower energy than typical disordered configurations. And if you look at stripe-like antiferromagnetic configurations on the triangular lattice, they have kind of an even higher energy. So you tend to favor this kind of ferromagnetic states. And the different ferromagnetic orientations have slightly different energies, and that's because of spin orbit coupling here. Okay? So the 111 direction in this particular case has the highest energy, and the 11 bar, and this 111 now is just pointing perpendicular to the plane of the bilayer. The 11 bar 0 is completely is lying in the plane of this bilayer, and that in this case has the lowest energy. And the energy differences are on the order of a few millivolts. Okay, so it's consistent with the kind of magnetic exchange scales that we inferred from the previous studies. Namely, it's not a very big magnetic exchange, but nevertheless, we expect that if you just do a naive calculation of TC because of this Ising-like anisotropies in the system, you expect that there will be an ordering transition, a magnetic ordering transition. It's not a Heisenberg system. And the kind of transition temperatures one expects are about 100 Kelvin. So it's much lower than bulk, but it's still significant that you can start asking about the physics in the magnetically ordered state in these systems. Okay. There's another ingredient, two ingredients that we need to really keep beyond the simple. So this is kind of physics, just assuming it's like the same bulk thing. I've just thinned it down to the bilayer. But there's two other things that start happening when you look at the bilayer, one of which we've taken into account and one which we're kind of working on at the moment. One of them is what's called trigonal distortion. Okay, so you can take this octahedron, which is perfect in the bulk, okay, but in the bilayer, you can take this octahedron and you can just by symmetry, you can sort of squeeze it or stretch it along along the 111 direction. And that's kind of schematically illustrated here. It's probably too small to see. So you take the two triangles of the octahedra, and then you can sort of either squeeze them or stretch them apart. So that's allowed. A second term that's allowed because of the fact that the two sublattices have different atoms is a natural Raspa interaction, but we've kind of not taken that into account at this stage of the calculation. So here is then kind of the electronic phase diagram of the system. Okay? So we can vary, let's say, the extent of this trigonal distortion, where G positive corresponds to compression, G negative corresponds to stretching. And this thing here is one of the hopping terms, which is important, which is an interorbital term, which is present between the molybdenum to molybdenum, but an interorbital hopping term. And so this is just a schematic. So it's kind of a many-dimensional Hamiltonian here. We've just looked at kind of tuning two of these parameters and just asking what the electronic diagram is. And we find that there are different magnetic orientations that get stabilized depending on the competition between these two parameters. So you can have, but typically there are basically only two that are dominant. One where the magnetic moment points out of the plane, and one where it lies in the plane. And those are, and you can sort of switch between them as you tune the distortion and the interorbital hopping. If we zoom in on a part of this phase diagram, we actually find bands which have churn number 2 that form a quantum anomalous Hall insulator. Okay, so that's this little region here. But over a pretty large regions, we actually find if the magnetism is along the 111, in fact, this churn insulator state is part of a whole region where the bands actually carry churn number 2. Okay, so there is a large fraction where if the moments were aligned perpendicular to the bilayer, In fact, a significant slice of the space diagram is occupied by bands which carry churn number 2. Okay, so what I want to spend time on now is just telling you sort of, you know, that confirming that this is a anomalous Hall state by looking at the edge spectrum, and then sort of going to asking this question about how do these churn number 2 bands emerge naturally in this problem. Okay, so we've looked at sort of just the edge spectrum, and we find that so there is this one edge state which is actually not. This part is not topologically protected because I can push it down. But there are these two right movers that are these purple states that live on one edge. And then there are these blue states here that live at the other edge. Okay, so you can see that, you know, it's just confirming that, in fact, there's a consistent story that, in fact, there is a churn insulator with churn number 2. And so what we've looked at now is, you know, where does this, you know, why do you get these churn number 2 states in this problem? And one way to think about this is to say that, look, you know, if I have these iron moments that are ferromagnetically aligned on one sublattice, what the molybdenum electrons are doing is they can sort of delocalize. Okay, they don't see a direct Zeeman field from the ion, but they are delocalizing onto the ion sites. Okay, and so one process that happens, for instance, is that this molybdenum electron can hop to the ion site and then hop back. Okay, but only if it has a spin that's opposite to the ion moment. So that means there is one component. So it's somewhat like an indirect Zeeman splitting that happens because one of these spin species can delocalize and lower its energy. Okay. So there is a Zeeman splitting, an effective, like what one might call like a kinetic Zeeman splitting, where you take this J equal to 3/2 manifold in which this electron is sitting, and then you Zeeman split this thing. And now it turns out that all the action actually goes on, so that we're interested in, goes on in these lowest two bands. Because remember, the electron, there's just one electron in this 4D state in molybdenum, and all we're interested in is asking then what happens to this manifold. And it turns out that these two, the bands coming from these two actually never cross the bands coming from the higher states here. Okay? So one can construct an effective two-band problem on the triangular lattice. Okay, so there's a J equal to 3/2 and a J equal to 1/2 state. Okay, so time reversal is broken, strongly broken. And it turns out that the hopping processes naturally become complex simply because of the eigenfunctions associated with these two states. Okay? And so if you look in momentum space, the magnetic field corresponds to having like a double strength vortex at the center, and strength minus 1 vortices at the corners of the Brillouin zone. And the mass is such that depending on parameters, you can either have the same mass or the opposite mass at the center, at the gamma point, and at the two corners. Okay. And so you can actually get, depending on the strength of the Zeeman splitting, one can get either a trivial insulator where the mass is the same, or one can get these churn number 2 insulators where the masses are opposite at the gamma point and at the two points here. Okay. So the transitions out of these states, yeah, I'm done. So the transitions out of these states are that this one here will basically be like a transition. If you want to drive a transition from this churn insulator into a normal insulator, there are one of two possible ways. So these are, of course, related by symmetry. So one can drive a transition where you change the mass here. And that transition is basically just massless Dirac fermions at the transition. We know that that's stable to interactions. And so you can sort of have a situation where this churn number 2 insulator just becomes a normal insulator because of this. The other option, and this kind of a little bit trickier, is you change the sign of the mass here at the gamma point. But then this is tricky because it turns out that this is a quadratic band touching point with winding number 2. And so if you try to drive this transition, very likely you will get intermediate phases because we know that these quadratic band touchings are unstable in two dimensions to correlation effects. So this is kind of something that we're still working on, how correlation effects actually allow one to drive some of these phase transitions out of these churn insulator states in this problem. So I'm going to just stop here and summarize. So these double perovskites are, you know, interesting systems because, you know, they give rise to, you know, possible interesting applications and interesting physics, as we've discussed just now, including something which I didn't touch upon in this talk, which is the physics of spin liquids, which I mentioned in the beginning with these FCC spin liquids. We've looked at some aspects of, you know, strong correlation and spin-orbit effects in these bulk systems and find sort of that we can reasonably describe the experiments. And finally, some partly work that's completed and partly ongoing, thinking about some of these heterostructures where there are these interesting, and I realize I have to use this word emergent, so that's it. Yeah. So, and so trying to think about mod correlations. So, thank you for your attention.
Yeah. So typically, how large is Hubbard U in such
kind of system? Hubbard U is. So in the 4D, it can be reasonably strong. So in the 4D, I think it's about 10 times the spin orbit interaction. Right.
So what's the ratio between the band
width? It may be about 3 times T. Yeah, so you're probably not very far from driving mod transitions in this system. So what's not clear is, I mean, if it goes into a polarized ferromagnet and it's half metallic, and then correlation effects will play no role, pretty much. Now I'm a theorist, I don't know. No, I'm sure one can, but I just haven't seen, studies. No, so most of these, okay, so most of these, the bulk systems are actually powder samples.
Right? No,
one can dope them, but there is no single crystals. And part of the reason is because very often these two sites just exchange positions because the two atoms are very similar. Right? So the cleanest way to grow them actually is what these people have done, which is go along 1-1-1 and either use MBE or they use thin film growth. You can actually grow, yeah. So they've grown very clean heterostructures. So that kind of provided a motivation for thinking about this.
Yeah, I think if you have a single crystal, you can just using some other method like ion dating.
One could, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Since there are two subsystems, one is this local moment in the iron lattice, mm-hmm. and another is some kind of conducting electrons in the molybdenum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it looks like chondrolattice. Does it have any spin-orbit coupling? Does it give any advantage to think in terms of the chondrolattice problem?
No, it's almost exactly like the chondrolattice, except it's not local. Like typically in the chondrolattice, one thinks of this very local way of coupling them. Here it's not local. The other thing is it's kind of in this limit where we've treated it where the local moment is very classical. Right. So one could ask if there are systems where, in fact, you can get kind of lower moments and if there is interesting.
Spin is five halves.
So here it's spin 5 halves, so it's very classical. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, one can think about this physics away from that limit.
So you have examples of systems where the iron is replaced by a smaller moment?
No, not often.
I have a question actually. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that when you include interactions, you get a proper moment that compares with methods. So what part of that is due to Hubbard versus Hund's coupling? Like, can you say which one is strongest, or they're both order one effects?
No, I think they're both comparable, actually. Yeah, it's hard to. I mean, they're both of the order of about an electron volt or something. So it's hard to distinguish. I think it's kind of the Hund's coupling that's playing a role. That's more important here. But yeah, I'm not sure if, I'm not sure how I would convince you that's the case. But yeah.
So in a hyperstructure case, what is actually the motivation to propose this kind of thing? I mean, just because the triangle frustration of
So in principle, I mean, as Zhengqing was also asking, I mean, there are correlation effects that are important, right? So we've looked at situations where, I mean, in this SFMO, normally people in this material, in the bulk, they don't talk about correlation effects. But once you start going to lower dimensionality, you might expect it might be easier to drive it into a Mott insulator simply because the bandwidth is smaller, right? The other thing was, you know, if one starts with a situation where you can have some interesting So if you start with this Chern-Insulator state, and then you start asking what happens if you start building MOT correlations on top of that, the question is there anything interesting? Yeah, I don't know actually whether we've not actually thought very much about this last question that I've put there. But it's just something we're kind of starting to explore.
Again, here one spin will be large and one will be small.
Yeah.
If you get a spin.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what happens if you add some Z-man field in the mod space?
So as I said before, we haven't actually discussed the MOT physics at all. We have not actually done this calculation of the MOT.
Yeah, typically if we want to have like a Cairo spin field, it's pretty easy to add some Z-man field.
Right, so I don't know if one can get, I don't know if it's, maybe this will be spontaneously, I mean, given that the magnetic moments are different on the two sublattices, it's possible that this will have like a big component of the magnetization just coming from the ion moments. And then there may be like a component coming from the edge states. I'm not sure how it will work out if you do have. I mean, I'm not sure whether one should call it. Okay, I don't even know whether one can stabilize this kind of a state in this problem.
If there are no more questions, let's thank everyone again.